for live streaming. I think we all know who the speaker is. I was trying to think something I could say about Jim, and there's a lot I could say about Jim. The one thing I was going to say is, you know, years and years ago when Brother Joel and I used to go to Missouri and go to young people's outings and stuff, you know, at the time I thought Jim was fairly old then. And but the cool thing is I've caught up with him. He's just stayed still all these years. So certainly if you know Jim, you know he's a worker, and he's always helpful. He's always going to be there at a work party or at someone's home or in the shadows fixing or doing. And I do know that he's a worker for the Lord too, and his desire is to serve him. And I know he comes this evening with a message upon his heart, and I'm glad we had the opportunity that he could share that with us. Our brother Jim Case.
Good evening to each one of you. I didn't realize that my age was showing that badly. I'm kind of like my cousin, David Larson. The other day, his wife brought home this very beautiful carved piece of wood that had a mirror behind it. And she says, "Did you see what was laying on the kitchen table?" And he says, "No." And so he went in there and he looked at it. He says, "That looks pretty nice. Don't like the face in there, though." As long as I don't look in the mirror, I don't feel nearly as old as I really am. And once in a while, I find out that age has caught up with me. You know, and I know that because when you get old, you get emotional. And so if you see me shaking or nervous, it's age. I came, and I'm going to be honest with you all, I came with a burden on my heart to this part of the country. And it's not something that you have all done or anything of that nature, but rather a burden that the Lord has placed upon my heart. And I determined that I was going to remain silent unless God saw otherwise. And when I heard our brother during the reunion, Brother Dwayne speak of the things that he spoke of, I thought, ha, it's been taken care of and I don't have to worry anymore. I'll get to listen to Aaron this evening, and lo and behold, Aaron has got other concerns and not able to be with us this evening, and didn't think too much about it until I was asked to speak and realized that, oh dear, this burden hasn't been lifted after all. I particularly enjoy hearing when someone is able to take a portion of the scriptures and in a way kind of bring it to life to you, that you can almost see what's going on. And our sister did that tonight with Mordecai and Haman and Esther. A story that I know all of us have heard. And she covered in just a matter of minutes a number of chapters, didn't she? That's my dilemma tonight. I have a number of chapters to cover. This originally was started. I don't have a good command of the English language, let alone Spanish, but I was down in Honduras and they asked me to do a Wednesday night service. And I said, "What is it supposed to be?" "Do whatever you want to. You can preach, you can have a prayer and testimony service, you can have a class, you can do whatever you want to." So I asked the Lord, "What ought it to be?" And I don't know where the thought came from except for him. From him, he says, "How about an open book test?" Okay. What book are we going to be reading? Or are we going to be studying or be tested on? And it's the Book of Mormon, found in the Book of Mormon. It begins on page 687, and I'm not going to read all this to you, so you don't have to turn to it. But if you'd like to verify these things later, you're more than welcome, because I'm prone to making mistakes. I've titled this, and you're going to laugh at that, but An Introduction to a True Veteran. Because I look at Mormon as I read through those chapters, and I saw a man that was truly a veteran of many wars, and a man who stood for those things that were right, that were just, even though the people that he was serving were wicked. I'll begin with the first chapter, and actually I'm going to bring some information from the fourth book of 3 Nephi along the way, and you'll pick that up as we go. Because it was about the year 320. And you know, and we think that was quite a long time ago, but think about the fact that Lehi came in 600 BC. And so we have about 900 years of 920 to be exact, of history that's gone before this. And so really it's a short time in the eyes of God. But it follows the things that were prophesied that would take place. It says that there was a man named Amaron, and he was the one who kept the records, and he, being old and not having someone to give them to continue that responsibility, he went and hid them up. And about the same time, he went to Mormon. And kids, I hope you're listening here, because I'm going to be talking to you tonight as well. Mormon was only 10 years old when Amaron came to him. And interestingly enough, Amaron says, "I perceive that you're a sober child." Now, I want to stop there for just a moment, because, you know, in our day and time, we think of that word and we say we're talking about someone who's stopped drinking, right? They no longer take alcoholic beverages, and they've been sober for 24 months. You know, we don't say 2 years, because 24 months sounds more impressive. In reality, that was not at all what Amaron was saying. Rather, he was saying that, and this is a definition that I have kind of derived from the dictionary, but it's in my own words. Mormon was a young person who was not easily influenced by the things that was going on around him. You know, he weighed what was happening, he looked at it, and he knew it for what it was. And he wasn't influenced by it, no matter whether it was good or evil. You might say that he marched to his own drum, maybe, would be another way some people might say it. But he wasn't easily swayed. And so he took these words of Amaron and just kind of put them in the back of his mind, and apparently kind of forgot about them as time went on. He tells us, and this is something else that to me is quite interesting, he tells us that the following year, which would have made him 11 years old, his father carried him to the land of Zarahemla. And all the way along, there were buildings and people and much commerce. You know, and we think in our minds that in those times that there must have been great distances between the various villages and so forth. Not so. The land was covered with people. And shortly war broke out. And he enumerates who they are. They were basically Nephites and the Lamanites. And of course, it seems as though those who were considered Nephites, those individuals never changed. They were all either Jacobite, Josephites, or Zoramites. And of course, the Lamanites were either Lamanites, Lemuelites, or Ishmaelites. a few years passed, and when you think about, actually they were pretty short years, only 5 years passed. And this young sober-minded child had already grown to manhood, in a sense. And having an understanding of the things of God and a desire for what was good, he wanted to turn his people around. And I have to think about that for a minute. At the age of 15, what I've been doing? Well, I'd probably just barely quit playing marbles, you know. I had just barely begun to think as somewhat like an adult, like what Paul tells us, that we think as a child when we're little, and as we grow up, we begin to think as adults. And probably my biggest concern at that point was to get my driver's license, if you want to know the truth. Which did happen, and maybe for the better or the worse, but at any rate. At the age of 15, his desire was not a driver's license or a team of mules or whatever, but rather to go and preach to his people and to try to turn them around. Because if you read back in the old, in the fourth chapter of 3 Nephi, you find that there was all kinds of things that were going on already. That just as would have been prophesied that before the fourth generation would end, there would be a wickedness amongst them. Perhaps we'll read some of that after a while, I'm not sure. Can you imagine having a desire to preach to the people and try to get them convinced that there's a better way of life, only to have God tell you to cease? Well, verse 17 tells you exactly that in the first chapter of Mormon. And the reason was no better. He says, they have willfully rebelled against me. Now, if we were to go back to, well, I will do it. We'll go back to verse 29 in the fourth chapter, or first chapter of 4 Nephi. And this is just that 210 years had passed away, and there were many churches in the land. Yea, there were churches which professed to know the Christ, yet they did deny the more part of his gospel, insomuch that they did receive all manner of wickedness, and did administer that which was sacred unto him to whom it had been forbidden because of unworthiness. The thing, very thing that we were cautioned about this morning, that when you partake of these emblems, be prepared. Be worthy of the blood that our Savior shed for us. And this church did multiply exceedingly because of iniquity and because of the power of Satan, which did hold up on their hearts. And there were other churches which denied the Christ, and they persecuted the church of Christ. And because of the humility of the church of Christ, they did despise them because of the many miracles which were wrought among them. And the same thing is true today. Even when this book came forth, what was the story then? God is no longer a God of miracles. He's done his work, and now it's up to us to continue. There were other churches that received all manner of iniquity. And that's why he said they had willfully rebelled against him. Well, you would think that would be enough to discourage this young man. But at the age of 16, he was asked to lead their armies. Now, I know that you all have watched television and you occasionally get to see one of our generals. Do they look like they're 16 years old? No. You know, they almost look as old as me. That's only because they've been rode hard and put away wet too many times. But this young man at the age of 16 led the armies. And I wonder, how did he do that? Now, I was in the service when I was in my early 20s, and yet I wasn't prepared to lead any army. I wasn't even prepared to be a good soldier. As I go through this, you're gonna hear me compare myself to him, and I don't measure up, okay? But I hope that as I go along, it helps you to the comparison and to understand the gravity of things that took place. Because indeed there were many things that were truly horrible that happened. Now, one of the questions that I asked in that open book test was, how many years did this war last? And I realized that many times he says it was about the year so-and-so, and it was about the year so-and-so that certain things took place. And so my numbers are not precise, but they're close. And even then, they haunt me in a sense. And in reality, it probably wasn't the total number of years that war went on, but for 64 years they had conflict. And there was one space for about 5 years where there weren't any battles, and there was another one for almost 10 years that they didn't have war. And yet even in those periods of time, they were making preparations. I guess we could call that Cold War today, but back then it was preparations to protect themselves. Well, conflicts began again, and he, being at the head of the army, had gone with them. And there came a time when the armies were near that place where Amram told him the records were located. And you recall that he was told to go there when he was about 24 years old. And if my calculations are correct, he was closer to 30 when he had that opportunity to actually go get those records and make a recording of all the things that had taken place in amongst his people, the Nephites. And he did so. And he admits in one place that he is not writing everything that took place because he didn't want to harrow up your mind and mine with the events that happened. But I would submit to you that I wish that he had given us even more detail, because I think we need it. And that perhaps is my endeavor this evening. Shortly, and when I say shortly, I'm not recalling specifically, but it seems like it was around 15 years after he made this record, and that can't be correct because he was older than that when the final conflict took place. But he begged for time to gather his people in, and they had been pushed and pushed and pushed. And as is true with any conflict like that, as we were told this afternoon, violence is violent. And as they were pushed from one town to the next, or city to the next, the people that were left behind, probably the old and the invalids and so forth, they were destroyed. The Lamanites came through and just destroyed them. They didn't care. To them, they weren't human beings, you know. I recall one time when I was in a service, and this one has haunted me all my life, to be honest with you. I had a captain that came in front of the troops, and he says, well, my time with you guys is finished, and I'm headed back to Vietnam. And he got this very strange look on his face. And I'll never forget it. Someone else was going to take his command, and he says, I don't believe in killing people. But gooks aren't people. You know, they might look different than me, but they're human beings. They're part of the family of God. If they will only take hold of the truth. And some of them have, by the way. But he gathered his people in, and he prepared them for what became the final conflict. Well, in a sense, it really wasn't the final conflict, but perhaps one of the biggest that ever took place amongst the Nephites and the Lamanites. For years, he prepared. In the reading, I found that he had 10 generals that he named. Pardon me, 13. Each one of those generals, now I'm giving them a title that's not in your scriptures, but that's the best I can do for you. Each one of those men had 10,000 troops to their responsibility. And he armed them, he trained them, he prepared them for this final conflict. And I think, wow, that's a lot of men, 130,000 men. And then he says there was 10 more with their 10,000. Now we're up to 230,000 men. You know, that's almost the size, probably, not too far from what the size of our army is today in the United States. I don't know the exact number. I should have looked it up, but I didn't. And then he says that he armed their women and their children. Don't know if I can find it quickly or not. I'll try. I don't see it right off the bat, but he records that event when they first saw their enemy coming towards them. And he says that fear that is indescribable grasped every one of them's heart, from the littlest one of them clear up to the oldest. And they waited for the battle to begin. Have you any idea how old Mormon was when that took place? Well, here again, if my math is correct, I believe he was around, he would have been 74 years old. I'm only 69, and I'm not ready for battle. And as I look out here, I don't see even the youngest of you, except perhaps one, who's ready. Not that we're looking for that kind of event, I pray we're not. But at the age of 74, he led his people into that final battle. You know, and I can't tell you that it only took one day, because it's not clear. But when that battle finished, there was 24 standing. And apparently he wasn't standing very well himself, because he said that he was amongst the dead and they went by him thinking he was dead and didn't finish the job. And so he was amongst those that survived it. One of those generals happened to be one of his son, Moroni. Any of you who have been in the military knows that you don't want to leave the battle when it's still in progress. You want to finish it. And yet Moroni was told, you flee with these records. You record what takes place. It must have been a hard pill for him to swallow. Apparently it was the following day, so they may have had, but I can't swear to that. It, like I said before, things are not specific in his recording. But the battle ensued again, and it must have been a pretty short one, because there was only 24 of them, and who knows how many Lamanites. Because that part is never recorded. And his father passed away. I do want to read a few words to you. Some of the words of Mormon before that fateful event took place, and they're found in the third chapter. Third chapter is pretty short. I'm not going to read it all, of course, but I'm going to begin, I believe, with the 18th verse. He says this, my soul was rent with anguish because of the slain of my people, and I cried. How many generals have you seen cry? I've not seen one cry. He said this, so you fair ones, how could you have departed the ways of the Lord? Oh, you fair ones, how could you have rejected that Jesus who stood with open arms to receive you? Behold, if you had not done this, you would not have been fallen. But behold, you are fallen, and I mourn your loss. Oh, you fair sons and daughters, you fathers and mothers, ye husbands and wives, ye fair ones, how is it that you could have fallen? But behold, you're gone, and my sorrows cannot bring your return. And a day soon cometh that your mortals must put on immortality, and these bodies which are now moldering in corruption must soon become incorruptible bodies. And then you must stand before the judgment seat of Christ to be judged according to your works. And if it so be that you are righteous, then you are blessed with your fathers which have gone before you. Oh, that you had repented before this great destruction had come upon you. But behold, you're gone. And the Father, yea, the eternal Father of heaven, knoweth your state, and he doeth with you according to his justice and mercy. The words of a sorrowing general. Well, I asked him there at that in that open book test, I said, but mind you, I forgot to set the scenario for you, because as I recall, and I realize that a few days have passed since then, and so my memory could be altered. But as I recall, about the same time, there was a series of earthquakes that tremored down through California. And I quibbed a little bit that, you know, when I went over there the last week, that probably the California would slide off while I was there. Maybe because I wanted to be relieved of this responsibility, I don't know. And then as you get further down, and that fault line, it comes over close to Mexico City, and there they had a pretty major earthquake. That fault line doesn't stop there, it continues, and down near Guatemala, a volcano decides it needs to adjust the pressures in the internal parts of the earth, apparently, and it began to erupt. And you'd think, well, you know, things are settled, but no. Bonnie and I are sitting at breakfast one morning, and I'm not sure, but what it was the same day. I'm not positive on that. And we hear, boom. A few moments later, a little bit louder boom. And we're thinking, there's no jets around here. There's no sonic booms going on. Maybe it's Army artillery, because there is an Army base not too terribly far away. No, it was none of those. There was a total of five of those that we only heard three. And it's a volcano that's about 90 miles away, and yet we heard what they called the bangs. No smoke, no lava, no rocks. Just noise. I did not go and find the scripture, but I read it just to last night or this morning, I forget which, that says in the latter days that there will be those kinds of things that go on, that there will be earthquakes in diverse places and all manner of events. And there's one purpose for those things. And that's to wake us up. I feel like I'm speaking to the choir tonight because I'm not accusing any of you. And wished I knew how to reach the masses and tell them what's coming their way if they don't repent. No, in your neighborhood here, you can feel like there's not too many things going on. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. But I don't spend a lot of time inside of large cities. But San Diego is pretty large, and you got humanity everywhere. You know, and of course, this is kind of a side issue, but every one of them has their dog and they run the streets with them, and it's a problem. And just in those 2 days, I saw all manner of iniquity going on right there on the sidewalk. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, what is wrong with this nation? What will turn them around? Now there they are. They're on that side of the fault line, and everybody knows that someday that it's theorized that California will slide off into the water. Now whether it does or does not is immaterial. We shouldn't have to live in fear of what God is going to do to us. Rather, live with the joy of knowing we're serving Him with all of our might, mind, and strength. So that someday some general does not have to weep as Mormon did for his people. Because you can have all the armaments in the world. You can have every advantage possible. But if God is not on your side, you will not win. And the contrary is also true. You can have absolutely nothing to work with, and God will preserve you. Just a little example. I believe it's a Six Days War. I'm not a good historian or good reader, but as I recall, they had the Jews only had five or six machines on track that, pardon me, I can't come up with the right word for tanks, thank you. Such a simple word and I can't get it. They had only a few tanks, and of all those that they had, one would run. And yet the battle was theirs. Now that's not the only time that's happened. You can't find it in our history books anymore. But there was a time when they would tell you that during the Second World War, our troops couldn't understand why they didn't have a bigger battle at this one certain location. And when they captured the Germans, they asked, "Why did you run?" And they said, "Well, we've seen the armada that's behind you." And there wasn't a single ship out there. That's the kind of God that we serve. That's the kind of God that will preserve us if we live righteously. I know that we worry about the things that are going down in Honduras, and I likewise, I have concern for my family members and all those people that I've come to love, because I love them just as much as I love each one of you. God will preserve them if we're all prayerful and they're living righteously. And that's what it hinges on. I mentioned that there's places that it talks about those things that will happen in the end times, and I don't know if that's where we're close to or not. But he tells us in Luke in the 21st chapter about that. You can go to Mark in the 13th chapter, and he'll tell you about it. You can go to Matthew in the 24th chapter, and he'll tell you about those events that will take place. And then he tells you that that's not the end of all sorrows. So what are we supposed to do? And I phrased it a little bit differently with them there. I said, what can we learn from this? If this is what will happen to a people when they turn away from God, what can we learn? Well, yeah, serve God. But that's kind of that almost sounds trite, doesn't it? And it wasn't the only people that this happened to. You recall that the Jaredites were swept off to the last man. And he lived 9 months, well, 9 moons, to tell the story to others. You can go back to when Christ was crucified, and it tells you very plainly that those who were wicked were destroyed, and only the more righteous were spared. Can we expect him to treat us any differently? This event that I have just spoken of and tried to relay to you and make it come alive in your minds was recorded by individuals that had a very strong faith. And they testify that these things would come forth in a time when things wouldn't be so much different than what they were living in. And so he addressed us as Gentiles and he told us what we need to be doing. Well, I'm skipping a bunch, and it's kind of like your Sunday school lesson this morning. Your teacher kept apologizing for leaving so much out, and yet I thought he did a pretty decent job of trying to prepare us for the sacrament service. And so I encourage you to go back and read these words and let them put a fire on you that just won't go out. He wrote this. This had been his son Moroni that wrote it. Starting with in chapter 4 of Mormon in the 84th verse, he says, "Behold, I say unto you that whoso believeth in the Christ, doubting nothing, and whatsoever he shall ask the Father in the name of Christ, it shall be granted him. And this promise is unto all, even unto the ends of the earth." That's a promise. He didn't say, maybe, if you'll serve him, he will keep that promise. It's just that simple. "For behold, thus saith Jesus Christ, the Son of God, unto his disciples which should tarry, yea, and also all his disciples in the hearing of the multitude, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, and he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned." You know, oftentimes we'll say that we believe something, but belief is, pardon the phrase, but only skin deep unless there's an action that follows it. And that baptism that they were referring to here is one that is to be kept from that day forward. You know, every one of us have trials that come our way. We have discouragements that come our way. We have things that we think aren't right, or, you know, and we may be right and we may be wrong. That doesn't make any difference. We're to stay steadfast, no matter what. Because he says, "But he that believeth not shall be damned." And, you know, that's the two scenarios you have. He doesn't give you an option in between. You know, if you believe in Christ, then be baptized and take upon him your name. His name. Those words hurt deeply. Because I know so many good people that haven't made that step. Honest-hearted people. And I don't mean to judge them, but that's the words that are written. And I have to assume they're true. He goes on to tell you, "These signs shall follow them that believe in my name. They shall cast out devils, and they shall speak with new tongues, and they shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. And they shall lay hands upon the sick, and they shall recover. And whoever shall believe in my name, doubting nothing, unto him will I confirm all my words, even to the end of the earth." You know, sometimes we think these kinds of things have ended. Here again, I'm showing my age because I've seen so many of them. You know, I've seen the lame walk. And when I say lame, I mean could not walk. They were carried in. The hands were laid upon them. And they stood up and they walked from that day on. That's the God we serve. He is powerful. Verse 94, he says, "Be wise in the days of your probation. Strip yourselves of all uncleanness, and ask not that you can consume it upon your lust, but ask with a firmness unshaken that you will yield to no temptation, but that you will serve the true and a living God, See that you're not baptized unworthily. See that you partake not of the sacrament of Christ unworthily, but see that you do all these things in worthiness and do it in the name of Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God. And if you do this and endure to the end, you will in no wise be cast out. That's his promise. I'll not turn to it and read it, but if you were to go back into 2 Nephi, and I fail to remember the exact chapter, probably, I think it's the 12th, it's the 12th chapter, verses 79 to 90. You'll find another promise there that he gives to those who are righteous. He says, if you keep my commandments, I will preserve you and I'll prosper you. If I have to do it, I will destroy the wicked by fire. That's his promise for those that will serve him. I want those promises to abound amongst every one of you. I want you to have those blessings that come from no other source. I would that our days were filled with joyfulness. I would that our days were filled without having to see the wickedness that we're surrounded by. But that's not to be. Because if this nation does not change, the promises that are written there will be fulfilled. And I have not read a hundredth part of them. He says, if we will not serve him, he will wipe us off. He's done it twice, when he wiped all of them off. A third time, when he took all but the most righteous, or more righteous, pardon me. Did we think that he'll do any different today? I think not. Tomorrow we got to go out and meet the world, don't we? And how do we have the courage to tell them that these things which our society wants to tell us is okay, it's just an alternate way to live, and it's our genetics or whatever other reason that they want to give. No. I can't swallow it. And you say, well, why can't you? It's pretty simple. When God called it a sin to steal, we accepted that. And we put people in prison for it, don't we? But now we want to say, oh, it's okay if you marry another man and you're a man, or you can marry another woman if you're a woman. That's okay. I can't swallow it, because he said that's a sin. Really worse than a sin. It's an abomination in his sight. Because the first commandment that he gave Adam and Eve was to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And that certainly doesn't replenish the earth in any way, shape, or form. I don't mean to be getting into biology, because I'm not a biologist and I can't explain hardly any of that, but you understand. How do we tell our fellow man these things? How do we convince them? And I don't have the answers for those things. I wished I did. You know, I don't believe in magic, but the phrase is, I wished I had a magic wand and I could just wand it over people and suddenly their minds would be enlightened and they'd understand, but it doesn't work that way. Because God gave them a free will agency to make their own decisions. And I have to permit that, even if it's to their own destruction and to their own eternal destruction. And it saddens me. And for those of you that have become so dear to my heart, I want the very best. And the very best only comes when we have served Him for our entire life with all the energy of our souls. God bless you.